So I suggest we start with Patrizia Ferretti from University College in London. And Patrizia will tell us about the dynamic identity of somatic stem cells. Patrizia, please.
Thank you very much as the organizer for inviting me. I'm not sure I've got answer, and what I'm going to do today is just to discuss a bit of how our work over the years has developed and has been moving more and more towards trying to use some of the knowledge for regenerating human tissue. So there is a lot of emphasis on the humans and all the challenges that come with that. So here I thought to start by summarizing some of similarities and differences between development and regeneration. So in both cases, what we need is to have a population of cells that will be able to make set organs. And obviously this population has to grow to provide the right size and differentiate and achieve the correct patterning. But important differences between regeneration and development concern the structure that you want to reestablish during development, and that I've used just a little example of the limb, and you can see the different sizes. This is a newt limb blastema, so the gross area of the limb, and this is a developing limb bud. So we are talking about very different size, and when we go to humans, obviously this is even stronger. And then the environment is very different, because during development you have a normal environment, normal cells, whereas the regenerative process is in response to injury, and also response to injury adjacent to differentiated tissue, not to a tissue that is altogether developing. And so you have differentiated mature tissue and injury versus a tissue that is healthy and less differentiated while developing. And so if you think about the population of cells that are involved, just you can think about resident undifferentiated cells that gradually will become more lineage restricted during development. And as the issue of the existence of possibly this population in the postnatally, in the adult organism, and the other way of thinking that there has been a lot and there is evidence for is that the cells that are more mature can dedifferentiate, so can go back to a less differentiated state, or transdifferentiate, so change from one type of potential lineage to another. So somatic stem cells, I don't think I need to say much, but obviously they are multipotent and lineage restricted depending on the stage of development or which organ we're talking about in the adult, and they are the building block in development. But the importance is that also they're important in tissue homeostasis, and we don't always understand what the real role is. And obviously we're interested in repair. And as I was saying, we are getting more towards trying to use these cells for repair and to rebuild structure where they cannot be rebuilt. But also they're very important for disease modeling because they provide drug screening platform. So our interest in understanding more of the somatic stem cells are really very much in this context of either trying to stimulate endogenous regenerative potential or develop cell-based therapy or modeling. So there are two areas that my lab has been interested in because we are part of the Institute of Child Health that is associated with Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital. So the issue of developmental diseases and how we can repair some of the birth defect is really very important to us. And also, there are two areas and two types of tissues that do not regenerate. And so the craniofacial skeleton, and that people think that bone can regenerate, but they don't normally. They can repair, long bones can repair, but they do not regenerate. And obviously the central nervous system that can be affected, just during development perinatally by a number of trauma like hypoxia, or obviously there is a traumatic injury. And this links to, just an all-standing interest when I have more funding for working more on models, simple models. So that goes to the regeneration that something's not showing for mysterious reasons there. But fundamentally, what is showing here is that if you take a new jaw, upper or lower jaw, you have just a very impressive regeneration of the structure. And obviously, this does not happen to humans. And when you look at the neural regeneration, you go from amphibians where you can have very significant regeneration of the spinal cord, either by sectioning the spinal cord or amputating the tail. And then as a chicken, I'll talk a little bit about this model, but when you go to mammals, that is much more limited. And another general point I'd like to make in the issue of regeneration and development and animal models versus the human is time, the issue of time. So most animal models used for regeneration develop quite rapidly. And so that is really very powerful because we can follow things very effectively. And they tend also to have a short lifespan. In contrast, humans has a very long developmental time. And also all the time that we are trying to develop, model, or study, or trying to in a way mimic a injury model in vitro, it takes a long time. So these are all just rather challenging issues. So the suitable autologous cells that are interested in, can we also generate these cells from disease tissue? And that is one of the other questions we want to address. But if we go and in the first part, I'll talk a bit about regeneration on the nervous system as a stem cell going back to animal models. And I briefly want to stress here the issue of the stem cells in the developing and regenerating spinal cord. So what we did, and then has been confirmed over the year with a lot of more extensive lineage tracing, is that if you look at a normal uridal cord, what uridals are the tail amphibians that can regenerate the spinal cord, you have that cells that are known as radial glia, the span from the central canal of the spinal cord to the pial surface of the cord, are maintained postnatally. And so these cells are negative for some of the neural cell markers, vimentin and nestin, and positive for other markers that are GFIP and the keratins. However, when you injure and you have the formation of what is known as an ependymal tube that looks very similar to the developing neural tube, we have activation of all these markers, so also the neural stem cell markers that are, in a way, dormant. So what is interesting here, if you look at the human neural tube, because I wanted to drive some parallel, we find that the human neural tube express at the early stages all the markers that then are reactivated in the in response to injury. But in the human spinal cord, like in the mammalian, we have lost this population. So that this work, and much more work from a number of laboratories, really has led to consolidate the idea that, just as the main cells giving rise to the regenerating spinal cord in neurodeals are these ependymoglial cells that are maintained in the adult, that in response to injury can be somehow reactivated to some extent, one could use the word dedifferentiation, and then in response to a number of stimuli, they can start rebuilding the spinal cord. But if we go to amniote, to more advanced system, like for example the cheek, do we have a similar event? So what's happening there? And the cheek is interesting because we know exactly when the regenerative capability is lost. So there is a transition around embryonic day 13 between regenerative permissive and non-permissive time for regeneration. So we know from a number of studies of retrograde labeling that this is true regeneration, it's not simple continuation of development. And also, when we started this study, it was believed that there was no neurogenesis by these stages, embryonic day 9, 11. So briefly, the difference, if you look at an injury at T11, you see that the injury at this point, you have limited cell death, apoptosis detected by tunnel. If you just do the injury a few days later, you have massive response and a lot of cell death that is very similar to what you find in any mammal postnatally. And when you go back and look at the spinal cord and the growth zone, you see that, like I have described in the amphibian spinal cord, you have activation of certain markers. So this is transitin, and transitin is equivalent of nestin, so a neural stem cells marker. And we have the activation when we have the injury at T11, but we don't see the activation when we injure at T15. So we wanted to understand a little bit more if the cells are different. We use, among other things, a neurosphere assay, and we see using different markers there is heterogeneity. But what is important pointing out here is that the ability of forming these balls of stem cells changes dramatically between E11 and E15. So there is a change in the cells. And in response to injury, we have, again, that's a neurosphere that we induce in injured spinal cord as early stages are also of much larger diameter. So we wanted to know whether, just that we have neurogenesis effectively from these different stages. And if we do a labeling with BRDU and then use a new N that is a mark of mature neurons, we could find cells that were double labeled. So there was a confirmation that at these early stages there is de novo neurogenesis. So we are really excited until we look carefully at the controls. And what we found that also in the sham-operated animals, we had some neurogenesis, that it was not as extensive. So it was when we quantified a bit less, but nonetheless was there where we're not expecting. So the idea that we are reactivating neurogenesis didn't seem to be correct, and we didn't see any neurogenesis if we did the same experiment as in non-regenerative stages. So what we believe these have been telling us is that fundamentally, we can have a regenerative response when we have still some neurogenesis going. So going to the general question about the differences, we have still an environment that is permissive for neurogenesis. That is the case in the chick at this stage, as it is in the case in the amphibian and fish that keep producing cells to some extent throughout life. That is particularly obvious also in the fish spinal cord. So altogether, our take-home message is that basically you can recruit stem cells for regeneration when you are in an environment that is already permissive for that, and there are cells that are already doing the job, so to, at a lower level. And there are a lot of studies just supporting this, and just one that I like to mention concern the olfactory system in mammals. And we'll hear from other people here in the meeting over the next couple of days about other examples. So what you get here, for example, is that the olfactory neuroepithelium that is continuously renewed during life basically can undergo some spontaneous regeneration upon injury. We wanted to know a bit more about some cellular and molecular mechanism. And so we carried out just quite extensive screening using microarray to look at changes in gene expression response to injury at permissive and non-permissive stages, and also some proteomics analysis where we identify some proteins that were not regulated as a gene level, but they were regulated as a post-translational level. And I like just briefly mention, because that links with some of the work we've been doing in humans, one of these molecules that we looked at. And that is a family of enzymes called peptidyl arginine deaminases that convert protein-bound arginine to citrulline. And so it's changing the protein charge and its conformation. And what happens, to cut a very long story short, in the spinal cord is that There is upregulation as a stages that are not permissive for regeneration, and very small changes as a stages permissive for regeneration. So it seemed to be a negative regulator. And we went on to show that it is involved in cell death. And when we use an inhibitor of this enzyme, we can significantly reduce cell death. So reducing cell death is rather an important point in response to injury, because, for example, if you think of damage to the human brain or stroke, the initial damage can be quite limited, but then it's a secondary damage that really creates a massive disruption. So we wanted then to see whether these enzymes are also active on human cells, and we use neural stem cells, and constructed some vectors that were overexpressing the pads or expressing the enzyme without the active sites. And what we found is that overexpressing the pads were increasing cell death, and that was all quantified. And we could inhibit these either by using siRNAs or by using the inhibitor. So it seems to play also in the human. And the other point I wanted to make here is that this type of cell death was not mediated via caspase-3 predominantly, by via the apoptosis-inducing factor. So what inhibition of PAD was doing was blocking the translocation of AIF to the nucleus that was induced by increasing the calcium. Because this enzyme, I haven't stressed, are calcium-dependent enzymes. That is a very important mediator of cell death. So we wanted to know a little bit more about what PADs are doing and if they are expressed in development. And again, we look both as a chick and we look as a human. And we find that there is a PAD expression both in the human neural tube and in the chick. And here I'm showing you the chick neural tube. And in the chick neural tube, what we find is that just through development, there is expression not only of the PAD3 that was the one we identify in our screen, but also of PAD2. However, when we look at the neural stem cells from the cheek in culture, we find that there is only PAD3 expressed, whereas in the human cells, both PADs are expressed, also the neural stem cells, making the interpretation of the results a bit more complicated. And one of the things we did, we use these cells in vitro, because we're expressing only the PAD3, in a scratch assay to see how the cell responded. So we didn't see any dramatic cell death, but what we saw when we are putting in the inhibitor, so we are not doing anything apart from creating a situation where the cell can migrate, we could see that there was an inhibition of migration when we are treating the cells with chloramidine, with inhibitor. So this led us to suggest that PAD has an involvement in migration. So what we think, it's the working hypothesis here, is that calcium is a very important regulator both of development and of the regenerative response. So when we have a major injury, the level of calcium goes up very significantly, and that induces the activation of PAD that will result in the cleavage of AF, the translocation to the nucleus, and that results also in cytoskeleton disassembly. And the disassembly of the cytoskeleton, so some control of the cytoskeleton, we can immunoprecipitate the protein with the PAD antibodies, is also consistent with the defect that we see in migration. But this control of migration is probably what is more, we suggest, is more of a role of PAD during development. And obviously, we need to manipulate the embryo in vivo to validate that this is the case. So I've alluded to the use of human cells to see whether there were shared roles of the PAD enzyme, but can we use this system to model the disease? And we have developed a number of models, and I'm going to briefly mention a couple of things for the sake of time. And so one is increasing the calcium levels using Tapsigargin. Then we have been mimicking oxidative stress by treating with oxygen peroxide, H2O2, and hypoxia, and I will not discuss the hypoxia today. And the other things that we have been doing is putting quite a bit of effort in trying to establish 3D culture models to have a more realistic tissue-like situation, in a manner of speaking. And so we find that when we put human neurostem cells in 3D, they behave very nicely, they form nice network, and they change very dramatically their gene expression. So we are in both cases, you are in laminin-based condition, but just the tridimensionality is changing gene expression. And if you use Tapsigargin to mimic the calcium injury, we can see that cells are affected throughout the thickness of the gel. So the Tapsigargin is penetrating the gel. But we see both in the human neurostem cells and the neurons that we have derived from the same cells that the concentration of Tapsigargin inducing death at 50% is different in 2D and 3D. So the cells, when they are in 3D, seems to be more resistant, more protected by injury. And that is an important point, because if you think about the use of certain drug developing treatment, obviously testing this compound on a monolayer might give us quite a false impression of what might be worth developing and studying more in depth. And then we used this model further to study two models, and then only briefly going to say something about the trisomy 21. So as I said, we are really interested in a lot of developmental diseases of the nervous system. And trisomy 21 and Duchenne muscular dystrophy attracted our attention because of the neural impairment that is less well known concerning Duchenne muscular dystrophy. But one of the issues with trisomy 21 is what is causing the reduced gray matter volume, and can anything be done to, in a way, improve the conditions? So in all both cases, obviously, we have to use induced pluripotent stem cells. So my student Olivia generated a number of lines, and she asked a question whether this reduced mass is due to death of the neural stem cells during development, to their reduced proliferation, or to a potentially switching fate. And what she found is that there was, using both BRDU and Ki-67, that there is a significant decrease in cell proliferation in the trisomic neurostem cells. But there is also a significant increase in the percentage of dead cells. Furthermore, she assess whether these cells, as have been suggested in patients, are more sensitive to damage, and whether oxidative stress might be a component also of the disease. And what she found is that if you treat these cells, that is in a normal 2D system with H2O2, you have, again, more sensitivity of the cells, of the trisomic cells, compared to the normal cells. So there is an increased sensitivity to stress, and these cells are defective. We moved that to our 3D system, and so we compare again 2D and 3D, and we get very much the same results. So the trisomic cells are more sensitive, both in 2D and 3D, but in both cases, the 3D is more protective. And that is true both for the H2O2 and the Tapsigargin. We found also that we have fewer neurons when you differentiate the cells in culture, but obviously, we don't know whether we have fewer neurons because neurostem cells are proliferating less, or because they are dying more at this stage. But we could differentiate quite easily because it's faster in astrocyte. And it's quite interesting that the astrocyte behaves slightly differently from the human neurostem cells. So the astrocyte don't seem to respond to the change in calcium, seem to be more protective by that. And also the response to the H2O2 is a bit different, it's a bit less dramatic. So again, we find that there is more protection in 3D than in 2D. So we don't know yet the causes, but one interesting point is that on chromosome 21, that is one replicated in this patient, there is also SOD1. So there is a gene that is superoxidismutase 1 that play important role in clearing harmful superoxide radicals. So we looked at whether there were changes in its expression with differentiation of the different cell types. So what we have here, if you can read, so we have that fundamentally in astrocyte, upon differentiation with astrocyte, SOD1, that is increased, so it's higher, because we have an extra chromosome in all the cells, so in the neurostem cells, neurons, and neural progenitor, but it's higher, even higher in astrocyte. And so what we are proposing at the moment is that SOD1 might be an important player, and its expression increase in astrocyte might provide some of the protection that we see in the system. And to summarize what I've just said about that, the data we have so far suggests that both changing in metabolism, increased cell death, and decreased proliferation are playing key roles in the phenotype of these patients. And now I'll move for the last few minutes to the other side, our other identity, that are the mesenchymal stem cells for repair. And this is all very much human focused. So the mesenchymal stem cells are, you all have heard of mesenchymal stem cells, are the bone marrow, are from the umbilical cord, from the amniotic fluid, but fundamentally they are present in all tissues. And we don't totally understand what they're doing in each tissue. And particularly in humans, they are quite difficult to study because, we are not fortunately experimental animals. So in addition to the idea of having some resident stem cells, like for example in the bone marrow, the cells can also arise by the differentiation, and that is very clearly exemplified in culture. And the example I give are the adipocyte and the chondrocyte, and these are of particular interest in the context of the craniofacial repair. So some of the questions are concern the phenotype and differentiation potential and how it's modulated by the environment, because we obviously would want to maximize, and also whether mesenchymal stem cells derived from different tissue share a similar potential. Are they interchangeable? So to give you an example of the adipocytes that are of interest because they are very easily accessible. We can grow them also from small amount, and so these are all adipocytes from children that were used for filling craniofacial malformation, particularly hemifacial microsomia. So one thing that I want to point in this slide is that whether we isolate the cell via enzymatic digestion, obtaining a stromal fraction, or we get fat fragments that then will follow the differentiator, we have time lapse of this, and you can see really the cell losing their droplet, we end with a population that is indistinguishable. And we did a lot of analysis of gene expression, of behavior, and this reversal to the fibroblast-like cells really just makes the cell indistinguishable by the stromal fraction. And in both cases, they have the main three lineage differentiation potential, so they can obviously go back to adipocyte, they can make bone, and they can undergo chondrogenic differentiation and express all the proper genes accordingly. But these cells are also very sensitive to the environment, and one way we have demonstrated, again, that was more on the regenerative medicine side, by changing the surfaces on which we are growing them. So we had modified the surfaces of a biomaterial called POSPCU, either by increasing COOH or the NH2. And what we see is that depending on the modifications that we apply, we get a different fate. So the COH modification pushes the cells more towards chondrogenesis by upregulating the cartilage marker more in the differentiation medium as compared to a normal surface on plastic. Whereas plasma modification with NH2 supports the osteogenic differentiation. But is this all these cells can do? Because it has been suggested that they are not limited to the mesenchymal lineage. And indeed, we can induce epithelial differentiation of these cells with retinoic acid, the ERIS program in these cells. I wouldn't say that we get material epithelial, but certainly we get upregulation of the keratin and of the tight junction marker. And also these are functionally epithelial because if we look at the trans-epithelial membrane potential, we see that they are forming the tight connection typical of epithelia. And this is interesting, but poses a question and an issue about the stability of the differentiated state. So this that is quite exciting in terms of what this cell can do, but if you're thinking of using these cells to make a tissue that you then put back in a patient, do we have stability of this tissue? What is controlling, you know, this changing? So this is something that it's very important because one of the issues with human cells is to really reach maturation. And that is true both for the neural cells and for the mesenchymal cells. And in general, most people find that in culture, you can have an embryonic-like type of cells rather than a mature adult type-like of cells. But also this system gives us the opportunity of looking at cell interaction in these adult cells because by combining the epithelia that are generated from the cell type and chondrocytes that are generated from the adipose, we can combine them. And so this has two advantages. One that can allow us to study epithelial mesenchymal interaction in a human system, but also the other is that can give us the opportunity of generating more complex organs. For example, the trachea, that is a structure that is has a cartilage base, but needs to be covered by epithelium. So to summarize this, the adipose-derived stem cells can be used to differentiate along many lineages, and that I talk about adipocytic, chondrogenic, osteogenic, and epithelia, and we can also induce some neural markers, but I would really not say that we can make neurons from these cells, also there has been some claim in the literature. And another important thing is that can be easily reprogrammed to induce pluripotent stem cells. But obviously the question here is this due to a true plasticity of the cells, or do we have multiple progenitor? You know, we have a mixed population. So we went to clone these cells, and consistent with their easy reprogramming, we find that they express lower levels than normal embryonic stem cells of you know, pluripotent markers like NANOG-OCT4 and KLF4, but they express quite a lot. Actually, in the case of KLF4, it's quite high, but that is a marker also mesenchymal stem cells. And we don't lose any of this marker in the clones, so we look at the number of clones. And also, we don't lose the differentiation potential. So analysis of the clone shows that they all maintain, all the one we have analyzed, all maintain the three lineage differentiation along the mesenchymal lineage, and they can still differentiate also along the epithelial lineage. And we can still also upregulate some of the neural genes. So this analysis, this clone analysis, supports the hypothesis that these cells are really very plastic, consistent with the expression of the pluripotent markers and the ease of reprogramming, and contain a multipotent population of cells. What it doesn't tell us whether this plasticity occurs in vivo. And that, at the moment, is quite difficult to assess, certainly in the human system. And another brief point I'd like to make is whether are all these cells born equal, have the same properties. So isolation of the cells to have purer population using the CD markers, the surface markers, is a very popular approach that obviously we use like everybody else. And in this particular slide, what we're comparing were the mesenchymal stem cells from umbilical cord, from the fat, and our negative control were the neural stem cells. So we're expecting really a very different profile. But if you look at this profile, with exception possibly of CD15 and endoglin, they express all the same markers. So if you just stay with the facts, you could say that the neural stem cells are mesenchymal cells. And obviously they are not, because they express a completely different range of genes. And the other important things among the mesenchymal cells themselves is that once you differentiate them, they display a different differentiation potential. So you are showing the chondrogenic potential that is higher in the ADSCs than in the umbilical cord, whereas, for example, for the bone is opposite. So I think I've quite summarized these already, so we can say. And the point is really that we need several parameters to define these cells, and they are not all easy to assess without destroying the tissue or the cells. But then at the last 3-4 minutes, I like to address the question of whether we can use cells from patients and cells for autologous therapy. Do they behave once they are put in a dish in a similar way to the normal cells? And this obviously will depend on the disease, on the context. And we are interested in this case in the ear, so the microtic ear that hasn't developed properly. So if we look at the cartilage from the microtic ear and compare it with a normal cartilage, what we see is that there is progressive development. These are all human tissue, so it's human development. And you can see quite clearly that with development, the perichondrial region becomes more and more defined, and we have a very clear organization. When we look at the microtic cartilage, we have a rather different picture. So the cartilage nodules themselves look reasonably normal, but they are really sort of swimming in tissues that contain a very large amount of fat, and we don't get a very good definition of the perichondrial region. So in this sense, they are much more similar to the early development. And another interesting feature is that what we find are blood vessels in these cartilages. And that is something that is not normal in the cartilage, because the cartilage is a vascular tissue. So can we grow cells? Where is the defect there? Can we learn something about it? And what we have here, yes, we can grow cells quite effectively, as we have done. So the cells will de-differentiate like they do from normal cartilage, like they do from the fat droplets. When we look at them, they express the markers of the mesenchymal stem cells. And here we compare some of the markers with different culture conditions, because they're trying to get away from animal supplements. And we see that if you are in fetal bovine serum, they are indistinguishable. So they have really a mesenchymal phenotype like the adipose cells. But both adipose and here change their expression of CD105 when you change the culture medium. And this does not seem to affect the trilineage differentiation, well, at least for bone and cartilage. We don't know yet about the epithelium. So the other things that we did, we observed that if we grow these cells as organoids in culture, or spheroids, or just micromasses, but anyway, we're trying to mimic. And I don't have time to go in all the detail, but what you have noticed is that obviously there is expression of SOX9, as you'd expect. But by comparing the normal progenitor from normal cartilage and from the microtic one, we see a different definition that reminds of the nodules, that reminds what we see in the section. And when we look at the analysis, or we analyze the extracellular matrix that they have secreted, what we find is that the matrix is very disorganized in the mitotic ear cartilage. So we did proteomics analysis to see what was different between the mitotic ear, the normal ear, and the rib cartilage. And we identify quite a number of genes that support the idea that changes in the extracellular matrix are really important. So to summarize this, we can say that mitotic ear cells grow efficiently and can generate cartilage. So they can provide certainly a good system to study more mechanism of disease. However, the extent of maturation and the stability of this cartilage is not quite clear. So it's a question mark whether it would be sensible to try to use it for tissue repair. And the analysis of this culture and the proteomics supports the idea that there is a defect in the extracellular matrix. So altogether, studying the MSC in vitro is very valuable, but it still leaves open many, many questions. Certainly, how do these cells relate in a culture dish to what we have in vivo? And while there are some parallels, as I think that the analysis of mitotic ear has shown, there are a lot of question marks. And I'll stop here. And I'd like to thank some of the people that have done the work. Sophie is missing, so the main people done the work I presented are Eleonora, Athir, some of the work, Natasha. Olivia's done a lot of the iPS cells, so has Jenny, but I haven't spoken about that work, and the funders. And you for your attention. Thank you.